This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
So let's start with the definition. Menstruation is the cyclical shedding of the endometrium triggered by falling progesterone levels. So here you're seeing one menstrual cycle, which on average lasts about 28 days. Big landmarks here are menstruation starting on day one by definition and ovulation around day 14. The first part of the cycle, as you can see, is dominated by estrogen, which is colored in red. Estrogen's released from growing follicles in the ovary. And the second part of this cycle is dominated by progesterone, which is in green, which is released from the corpus luteum, which is what's remaining of the follicle after ovulation. So in the second half of the cycle, which is dominated by progesterone, you see that around the time progesterone peaks, a key component of the uterus, the endometrium, begins to decidualize. So during decidualization, the uterine lining prepares for pregnancy, and it's really characterized by this transformation of endometrial stromal cells into decidual cells. Lots of other things happen too, like a massive recruitment of uterine natural killer cells to the uterus. So one feature of decidual cells, but not their stromal precursors, is their reliance on progesterone. So if these decidual cells lose progesterone, they self-destruct. So if a woman doesn't get pregnant, she loses her source of progesterone, these cells self-destruct and menstruation starts. So this phenomenon of menstruation is very rare in mammals, but it's not unique to humans or even to primates. So what you're seeing here on this slide is a phylogeny of mammals with menstruating species highlighted. So among the primates at the top, we see that apes and monkeys exhibit menstruation. Among the rodents and rabbits, a little bit down the screen, you only see one species of thousands of species that has been shown to menstruate. This is the spiny mouse. Among the bats, there are a few species. And then all the way down the phylogeny, there's in this more basal clade of mammals that include elephants, there's one species, the elephant shrew, that we know menstruates. So this distribution is really interesting. It looks like menstruation has emerged at least four times in mammals. So it's a trait that isn't required for successful reproduction, since obviously most mammals don't have it, but it has popped up multiple times. And so to understand why the trait has popped up multiple times, I think it's useful to think about other characteristics that menstruating mammals share. And so that's what I'm showing here. So first, invasive placentation. So the degree that the fetal placenta invades the uterus is highly variable among mammals. So on the bottom of this schematic is the least invasive type of placenta, where maternal tissues are not breached at all by fetal tissues. In the middle is sort of an intermediate degree of invasion, and at the top is the most invasive form of placentation. So all menstruating species have this most invasive form of placentation. Second, extended mating during the reproductive cycle. So back to this chart here, in many mammals, copulation only takes place in this restricted window right around the time of ovulation, which makes sense. This is the time that a female can become pregnant. But in many menstruating mammals, there is this extended period of mating, which is really taken to an extreme in humans. Third is small litters. So menstruating mammals typically have fewer offspring per pregnancy, in contrast to many other species that have much larger litters. So menstruating mammals seem to have a higher investment into each offspring. And then last but not least is spontaneous decidualization. So decidualization is a process that any mammal with invasive placentation goes through. But in most mammals, it's induced when the blastocyst or embryo is implanting into the uterus. So in menstruating species, that's not the case. It initiates every cycle, whether there's a pregnancy or not. So there's no baby required in menstruating mammals to induce decidualization. That's why we call it spontaneous. So, of all the traits I just described, this is the one that's most tightly correlated to menstruation. Every menstruating species exhibits it, and no non-menstruating species exhibits it. And so, keeping all this in mind, let's broach the question of why menstruation evolved. So, people have put forth many theories over the years, which we summarized in our 2012 topic on the paper. I don't have time to go into details here, so I refer you to the paper for that. But I will say that many of the ideas have some major weaknesses. But there is growing consensus, I think, for one idea, which I'm highlighting here, which is that menstruation occurs as a non-adaptive consequence of spontaneous decidualization, that last trait that I just described. So, what is the evidence that menstruation occurs as a consequence of spontaneous decidualization? Well, there's really sort of two categories of evidence. One, I think, is the comparative evidence that I already mentioned. So, this tight correlation between these two traits. And second, there's quite a bit of experimental data that supports this connection. So, like I said, a feature of decidual cells is that they self-destruct when you take away progesterone. So we know this from cell culture experiments. We know this from mouse models of menstruation, which is what I'm showing you here on the right. So I mentioned the lab mouse, like most rodents, don't menstruate normally. But in this model of menstruation, you can actually induce menstruation. So you mate females to sterile males, then you inject oil into the uterus, which basically provides the mechanical stimulation needed to induce decidualization. It's kind of like tricking the female into thinking that there's an embryo around trying to implant. But since the female isn't actually pregnant because the male was sterile, progesterone levels decline. And since the endometrium had begun the process of decidualization, the loss of progesterone at that point induces menstrual bleeding. And so when we wrote this paper, we argued that we've all been asking the wrong question. The question isn't why did menstruation evolve? It really should be why did spontaneous decidualization evolve? So why do cells of the endometrium decidualize every cycle in menstruating species? This doesn't happen in non-menstruating species. And we still don't have an answer for this question, so I'll be honest here, but there is a hypothesis that I think has gained quite a bit of attention in recent years, which is that it evolved to increase biosensoring of embryo quality. So by switching from embryonic control to maternal control over the decidualization process, the mother basically increased her ability to reject embryos that don't have a good chance of making it through a pregnancy or even through childhood. And so I think a large body of work now tells us that there are many mechanisms by which mothers put embryos through some quality control. And so I've put two of these mechanisms on this slide that basically involve the decidua. There are others. And so in the first, on the top, we know that high fitness embryos secrete molecules that basically signal to the decidualizing endometrium to promote implantation. But low fitness embryos, which aren't producing enough of these molecules, induce a stress response in decidual cells. And this ultimately leads to tissue breakdown. A second mechanism involves different molecules produced by healthy embryos that essentially activate uterine natural killer cells to clear senescent cells in the endometrium. So, low quality embryos aren't producing these molecules. Natural killer cells aren't clearing senescent cells, and this ultimately leads to tissue breakdown. So one interesting feature here is that timing is really critical for this biosensoring. So if stromal cells haven't started differentiating, they don't act as biosensors. And if they've differentiated too far, they aren't effective biosensors. So timing is really critical, which I think is why it might be advantageous for the mother to control it rather than leave it to the embryo. So I think a really important question now is, why would menstruating species need better biosensoring than non-menstruating species? And one thing that we know is that humans have a very high rate of chromosomal abnormalities in early embryos. So, as you can see in this iceberg on the right, we know many human conceptions are lost. Most of them are lost preclinically before a woman knows she's pregnant. Some are lost as miscarriages later in a pregnancy. The rate of loss is estimated to be about 50%. These numbers are debated, but it is very, very high relative to other mammals. Now, when a female in a species is making such a high investment into each individual offspring, like I mentioned before, and have these high rates of chromosomal abnormalities, we would predict the evolution of mechanisms to screen through those aneuploid embryos as early as possible. So it's clear that the later a pregnancy is lost, the greater the harm to maternal health and, of course, to maternal fitness. I think to really test this hypothesis, we'd need to know the rates of chromosomal abnormalities in other menstruating species. We do actually know that it's quite high in rhesus monkeys, but I think we'd need more data from other species. I think another related but distinct idea has to do with something I shared earlier, which is extended mating in menstruating species. So, extended mating means that sometimes you're going to get eggs or sperm aging in the reproductive tract of the female before fertilization happens. And we know that this can result in developmentally impaired embryos. So a lot of studies have actually looked at this. One of the earliest was from the 1970s. I'm showing you some data from that here. These experiments were done on rabbits. And what they experiments showed is that the longer sperm aged in the reproductive tract of the female, the worse the outcome for the embryos. So clearly, the evolution of better biosensoring may have been important to prevent all of these impaired embryos from taking hold in the uterus. So, what can this whole story that I've been telling you tell us about human uniqueness and women's health? And so that's what I want to get to in my remaining time. I think to set that up, I want to mention that women today don't necessarily experience menstruation the same way that females in other species do, and even to our human ancestors. And so, among primates, as an example, monkeys don't shed as much blood as apes and humans. I think in human females, it's clear, for example, that women today have more cycles over their reproductive lives than in the past before birth control was invented. So, in this one comparison of women in the early 1900s to today, we're talking about 40 versus 400 cycles. If you compare American women to hunter-gatherers, who maybe are a better proxy for our human ancestors. This one study that I've just popped up reported 160 versus 450 cycles. The details vary across studies, but I think the point is pretty obvious: more cycles now than before. And this is clearly a case of evolutionary mismatch, which, of course, there are health consequences of that for women today. And so, what are some of those consequences? Endometriosis is one. This is a disease that affects 10% of women around the world. It is very painful. It can cause infertility. What is it exactly? So, it involves ectopic implantation of endometrial tissue outside of the uterus. So, in this slide, you're seeing some of those lesions on the outside of the reproductive tract. How does it get there? Well, we know most menstrual blood passes through the vagina and is shed from the body, but some blood flows backwards, so up the uterus into the fallopian tubes and out the other end. This process is called retrograde menstruation, which is the primary cause of endometriosis. This is not a human-specific disease. It's really a disease of menstruating species. Knowing this helps us choose models of endometriosis. So there are many studies on rhesus monkeys, for example. That said, I think this disease is probably expressed more extremely in humans today because of more frequent menstruation. So during every cycle, those lesions have a chance to grow, and there's a chance of developing new ones. Premenstrual syndrome and premenstrual dysphoric disorder, which is a more extreme version of PMS. So symptoms include mood swings, anxiety, depression, more physical symptoms like headache, nausea, joint pain. We know that PMS is much more common among affluent women. Many studies have looked at this. So we don't know exactly why. One thing we know is that levels of sex steroids are much higher in the West. And so that's what you're seeing here in this graph, looking at progesterone across the menstrual cycle, comparing women from Chicago to women from Bolivia. And so what you can see is that progesterone reaches a much higher peak in the women from Chicago. And this is actually seen across many studies. And we think it can be traced at least in part back to lifestyle differences, like differences in diet and exercise. And so one thought on PMS is that this steeper drop in sex steroids might actually cause more severe symptoms. So you can kind of think of it as this greater hormone withdrawal causing more severe symptoms. And I think there are some studies supporting this hypothesis, although I'd like to see more. Abnormal uterine bleeding. So this includes heavy menstrual bleeding, and this affects one in four women. So it's very common. There are many causes of abnormal uterine bleeding. This is a very large category of problems. So, and they include, as you can see in this figure on the left, more structural causes like fibroids, but also you're seeing on the right more non-structural causes like endometrial issues. Abnormal uterine bleeding can lead to anemia, poor quality of life. We know that the costs to women and society are significant. And here's a case where the number of cycles women are experiencing today really exacerbate the issues associated with abnormal bleeding. So back to this graphic, all these extra cycles that women have today really compound those costs for women and society and can really negatively affect the quality of life for women. One last issue I want to discuss is reproductive cancers. So back to this comparison between hunter-gatherers and American women, Americans have many more cycles for a number of reasons. So we get our periods earlier, we have fewer children, we breastfeed those children less. And it turns out that many of these factors are connected to a higher risk of reproductive cancers in American women. And you know, one thought is that when you cycle more, cells of the breast and the endometrium and the ovary are going through more cycles of proliferation, which basically means there's more of a chance for cancerous mutations to arise. And not only do women in the US have more cycles in their lifetimes, but I also mentioned that women in the West have higher levels of ovarian hormones each cycle. And so what's popping up here, this also correlates with the higher incidence of cancer. In this case, we're talking about breast cancer. And one thought is that these higher levels of sex steroids can directly fuel those cancerous breast cells to proliferate. Another idea is that higher progesterone levels during the luteal phase of the cycle, makes women more susceptible to infectious agents that are linked to certain reproductive cancers. I don't think that we've totally worked this out yet. And then lastly, so far I've been focused on women in the US who aren't using oral contraceptives. So these women are avoiding pregnancy with other methods. But obviously, the use of birth control is widespread. And studies have looked at this and have shown that oral contraception increases your risk of some cancers, so breast and cervical cancer, but decreases your risk of other cancers. Endometrial cancer and ovarian cancer. And we still have a lot of questions. So, for example, there are many different formulas out there. The formulas have changed over the years for these oral contraceptives. So, we really need more work understanding how much each formula is exposing a woman to these exogenous hormones, and then, of course, how each affects cancer risk. And this is something that some labs are actively studying right now. And so I wanted to end by zooming out a little bit as we think about the evolution of menstruation and women's health. And so I think an interesting question that has emerged recently is this one: is overall health cyclical in women? And if it is, how can we harness this knowledge to better treat women in the clinic? And so back to our 28-day cycle. We know that there are days in the cycle with very high inflammation and days in the cycle with low inflammation. So you can see that with the arrows in this figure. And we know that this inflammation is mediated by reproductive hormones. So progesterone, for example, is known to be anti-inflammatory. And we also know that sex steroids talk to immune cells. So changes in sex steroid levels across the menstrual cycle could influence our susceptibility to infection and symptoms of disease. And you can see that here on the right. This is a different representation of one cycle. The first half of the cycle's on the right of the image, dominated by estrogen in red. Second half of the cycle on the left, dominated by progesterone in green. And there are studies, for example, showing that symptoms of rheumatoid arthritis are exacerbated during menstruation, which is an inflammatory event, but symptoms are much better when progesterone is high in the secretory phase. And since rheumatoid arthritis is an autoimmune disorder, which, you can imagine it might be influenced by cyclical changes in inflammation. Higher progesterone in the secretory phase might be good for symptoms of rheumatoid arthritis, but there's actually a lot of evidence that it makes women more susceptible to infection. So I think we're starting to shift our paradigm here to think about changes in sex steroid levels and how they affect immune function and inflammation in the body, which may allow us to better treat women. So, for example, if progesterone impairs the body's response to infection, maybe there's a better time during the cycle to administer vaccination. Other questions of interest: does the menstrual cycle phase influence how cancer cells proliferate? And I think related to that, is there a better time during the cycle when we should administer chemotherapy or other medications? And so I will end there. Thank you so much for your attention. Thanks to my sources of support. And lastly, I wanted to mention that I cover a lot of these issues and more in my recent book. It's called A Brief History of the Female Body. So please check it out if you're interested.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at UCTV.tv.